is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Richard Spencer. Richard, great having you back on.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Alex von Goldstein.
It's great to be on with you guys.
So I guess where I'll get started is, Richard, you recently spoke at UC Berkeley, and there was a lot of kind of controversy surrounding this. It did get some news coverage, but I mean, it wasn't as chaotic as a lot of people were predicting. But there was this group that wanted to organize kind of a alt-right type of free speech group. And obviously, Berkeley is famous for going back to the kind of free speech movement of the 60s, or some might say kind of a quote-unquote free speech. But Richard, tell us about this group at Berkeley, and how did it all get started with inviting you to come and cover this and to speak there?
Sure. Well, the whole thing was hatched by myself and Nathan Damigo, who is the leader of a grassroots organization that is now called Identity Europa. And it recently changed its name, and I think that's a great name because it kind of has a almost French New Right identitarian aura to it, and I think that's very good. It's not a typical American conservative movement. But anyway, we hatched this plan, and we hatched it a number of weeks ago, and I was actually going into Berkeley to visit some readers and supporters and people like that, just in a private gathering. We do a lot of these around the country that we don't announce publicly, and but they're happening, and I think they're very, very good, and we're accomplishing a lot. And we decided, why don't we try something a little bit different? And we wanted to, we wanted to, in a way, take up that notion that is a kind of social justice warrior meme, and it's a very, in a way, a very stupid idea, and that is the safe space, you know. So, which you could see this trajectory of you know, the free speech movement. They've gone from, you know, actually saying, like, let's listen to these ideas that are radical, that challenge the system, that challenge our most basic beliefs, to you need to be protected from speech that might challenge you in some way or insult you or make you uncomfortable. And so there's been this major change. So we wanted to, in a way, adopt that whole safe space meme and kind of flip it around and say that, look, Berkeley is a stifling place. At the very least, in the humanities and social sciences, for a frank discussion of race and identity and things like that. And also, we wanted to create a safe space, and we wanted it to actually happen and actually work. So we didn't announce this weeks ahead of time. We didn't rent a room and have me give a big podium speech or something like that. We wanted to do something very different because my basic feeling is that if we did it the old-fashioned way, it would have been canceled. The administration would have done something. And there's actually a lot of precedence for that. So we basically announced it just about 48 hours ahead of time. And I was a little bit afraid that no one was going to be there, but I shouldn't have been afraid because we had the crazy protesters. We actually had a lot of people who were some people who were genuinely curious, some people who wanted to engage us and so on. And we went to Berkeley. It's hard to get more in the belly of the beast. It's kind of like the belly of the belly of the beast in terms of social justice warriors and just, you know, contemporary academic culture, current yearism, we had a civilized discussion. And there was some local media there that I spoke with, but I actually spoke with just a lot of regular people. And I really like this idea. You can do a lot with a little. Like you can kind of make an impact and make our movement, make it be known that, you know, I was joking, we should be chanting, "We're queer, we're here, get used to it." we're queer in the sense that we think differently. Although I guess it's the alt-right, you know.
I saw that interview you did with the reporter, I think it was from the Berkeley newspaper, and you said you jokingly said, "Yeah, I identify as a black lesbian," and she actually took you seriously.
Right. No. Well, you know how could she? I mean, how could she not? I mean, it's these are the dogmas of the modern university, and yeah, you know, it is funny. I would just mention this as an aside. A lot of those people. I think they when they went and talked, the media people, when they went and spoke with me, I think that they anticipated speaking with me for 5 minutes, maybe 10, asking me some basic questions. They would expect me to, like, give them some boilerplate racism, and then we could just go home. What I noticed is that we would actually speak for 30 minutes or 45 minutes, and that a lot of these people – they might very well be social justice warriors, but they actually are intelligent, and I think they get intrigued, maybe just by the danger of the ideas. And so I think that one girl I spoke to, her write up was saying that, like, I'm dangerously charming and coherent, which is pretty amusing. So you know, again, don't. I think this is also like something I would say to people. Don't be who they want you to be. You know, they want you to scream at them. They want you to, you know, chant, you know, we hate gays and we hate Negroes and Jews. They want you to do that. But don't do it. Because don't do what they want you to do. Because all you're doing is letting them frame you. We should frame them. You know, we should say we're creating a safe space. We're, like, use their language and flip it around. That's how you drive them nuts. And so, you know, that's how the left operates. They take a lot of, like, quaint Americanisms, like freedom and liberty and free speech, and they turn them to their
own. That's not
own
who
end.
We are.
Yeah.
Well, the thing with the group there is there wasn't, like, a explicit demands, like, we want this and we want these demands. Basically, all that group was asking for is they said, we just want a group where we can have our, like, freedom of speech and, like, discuss things openly.
Yeah, we weren't, right. We're not in a position to, like, take over a institutional building like leftists did, you know, in the late 60s. And I'm sure they actually, you know, did it many times since then. No, we're not in that position. We're in a position that we just want it. Let's say, look, these ideas are not being discussed at all on a college campus. If they're discussed, or I would say this, they're not being discussed in a serious fashion. If they are discussed, they're discussed only in a cartoonish fashion of, you know, oh, these people, ooh, Hitler, Holocaust, blah, you know, no one examines the idea seriously. We wanted to create for 2 hours a safe space. So all I'm saying is this, we did a lot with very little. I don't know the whole budget of that little happening. It was definitely under $1,000. It was probably under, you know, gas money and all that kind of stuff. And we created a splash. We got our ideas out there in people's minds. Red Eyes Radio, you know, they're good people there, Lana and Henrik, and they, you know, they did live streaming through people's mobile phones. And so we had our own television station, you know, organic television station right there. So I just think it's a great idea. I hope it becomes a thing, you know, as we like to say in our current vernacular. You know, when something becomes a thing, it becomes a ritual. We do this. I think it'd be very interesting if we start engaging with campus culture in this way, and we basically say, we're going to create a safe space. Let's talk about these ideas. We're not going to bite. We're not going to be your stereotype. We're not going to threaten you with violence or anything like that. We're going to threaten you with words. And let's do it. I think if this becomes a thing, that is, this starts to happen organically. I think that would be a great achievement because it shows also that we're not just going to give up places. You know, the left rules academia, but we're not going to let them. We're not going to give them, oh, this is your domain and we'll never go there. And, you know, you've won kind of thing. No, you know, we're going to invade your domain. We're going to do it obviously in a, you know, law abiding and civilized fashion, but we are going to invade it. And we're going to get our ideas out there. I think if more people pick up on this, I think it could be a really great meme. Because a really great thing because things are changing. Things have changed over the past year. What's happened over the past year just in political discourse has been tremendous. A lot of that is Donald Trump, a tremendous amount. A lot of that is the refugee crisis. I think that has, red-pilled people. They've been, life has red-pilled people. And I think things are changing. And I get it that not everyone is going to be an open identitarian. But the people who are willing to be open or maybe semi-open, I think it's a good thing just to go and say, let's talk about this stuff. This is important. Let's talk about it.
And with the event, I noticed you had kind of some, shrill, lunatics, just, yelling at you. But then you also had some, constructive conversations.
Yeah.
Some people disagreed, but they were engaging in conversations. And there were some people who maybe were kind of, they weren't necessarily on one side or the other. They were just kind of intellectually curious. Then it all ended up turning into a whole debate about Trump. And I saw the one thing about, you had a Bernie Sanders supporter talking about Trump, but then you had someone about a Ron Paul supporter, but in the end run, it all ended up being a debate about Donald Trump.
Right. I mean, and that's not too surprising. Donald Trump has just been this lightning rod. He's been a touchstone where he, through this person, we're able to talk about bigger ideas. And again, I never would have predicted this. I was just talking with a friend just before I got on this call about what has happened in the past year. And if you had told me, I think he announced that he was his presidential run, I believe in June 25th or June 24th, somewhere around there, or about a month, 5 weeks from now. And if you had told me now, a year ago, today, that Donald Trump is going to run for the Republican nomination and he's going to change change the discourse, not totally change it 180, but really change it, really open up space, I would have been like, first off, Donald Trump presidential run, that's a joke, that's ridiculous. Second off, no, that's never going to happen. And I obviously my a year ago self would have been totally wrong. I don't think Donald Trump is really an identitarian. I don't think he's thought through a lot of our ideas. That being said, I think he probably has thought through some of the other ones, some of them, and I think he does feel it in his gut that the a lot of these things that people in our movement have been saying for decades, and his reckless disregard for political correctness, his just desire to defeat his enemies, the people who are attacking him, he has opened up space for our ideas, and it's just been an amazing year.
Richard, do you think there's this meme of Donald Trump that played into gaining the trolls, winning over the trolls? Because the meme war that we're talking about, as far as academia goes, this is just beginning. But the one that existed on the in the internet subcultures, that seems to be completely won over by the alt-right. And you see YouTubers like Murdoch, who is directly talking about identitarian ideas, and then someone like Sam Hyde and Million Dollar Extreme, who are sort of implicitly talking about these ideas, but still opening up the door for Trump conversations. So I was just wondering what you think about that, the whole meme war of the last year.
Yeah, well, I think it gets back to what I said earlier, where Donald Trump is part of something bigger than himself. And I think in a way that's what a meme is, because the idea of a meme, I believe Richard Dawkins actually coined this word.
Correct
me if I'm wrong about that. He was one of the first. He used it, I believe, in also the book The Selfish Gene. It's a meme is a way of – it's a gene. It's a cultural gene. And so it's a way of spreading your gene, so to speak, on the level of society and culture. And so, you want to spread your genes by, having sex and reproducing and maybe even – you could even say defeating your enemies in some way that your genes will predominate. But you also want your cultural genes, your memes, to predominate. And what's been fascinating is that Trump, as this symbol, has become a meme in himself. Like he and Pepe, or a combination thereof. You know,
yeah,
Pepe
yeah,
with
yeah.
Trump hair, or green Donald Trump, or whatever. That has been this meme that carries with it all of these ideas. Some of those ideas are real basic stuff, like let's crack down on illegal immigration. But some of the ideas are really deep stuff, like identitarian ideas. And again, it's crazy. I never would have predicted it. It came out of left field for me. But I will say that I did recognize it. I would say maybe not the day that he announced, but a few weeks after that first big speech on, you know, they're sending us their rapists and their murderers. And just, you could see this reaction against Trump from both the mainstream liberals, but also the conservatives, the cuckservative element. Again, cuckservative, that became a meme last summer mm-hmm. after the Trump. It was certainly at least catalyzed by Trump, maybe caused by him. And I never would have predicted it, but I will give myself a little bit of credit. Once it happened, I was definitely thinking to myself, something's going on here. Like, this is bigger. This is bigger than just some Republican running again, you know, for president and claiming he's going to take back America. This is something different. And again, maybe this is going to end in disappointment. Maybe Trump could lose. Maybe Trump could win and disappoint us. All of those are definite possibilities. But the least I can say is that, you know, where we are now, Trump is this meme carrier. And that's amazing, because it never before, or not at least not in the recent past, has a mainstream popular figure been a meme carrier for us. You know, I mean, our meme carriers have been like, you know, read this article by Jared Taylor, or, you know, read this Revelo Oliver article from 40 years ago, or, you know, listen to Richard's podcast, or, you know, we've been, or Robert Stark's podcast. We've been carrying memes through very intellectual ends, and we've been kind of speaking to the choir and you know, ourselves. This is the first time in my recent memory where something popular is carrying our ideas. Again, amazing.
Since it is like the new counterculture, because it's sort of, it's not so much about like political ideology and all that. It is to a degree, but it's about kind of disrespecting the sort of social values of society, disrespecting them with using humor, being kind of irreverent.
Yeah.
Using humor. And that's kind of originally kind of that is how the left started, because there was a sort of, in the 60s, you had comedians like Lenny Bruce, and they used humor to sort of fight against censorship. And today you have people, the censorship is obviously coming at a different angle.
Right.
But I think the key thing is not so much like a political agenda, but just having a culture where people can be irreverent, abolish these sort of sacred cows, which are society's taboos about what you can and can't say.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, two things come to mind. First off is that sometimes you have to tear something down before you can build a new castle. Sometimes you have to tear down the old and start over. And I think a lot of this irreverence really is that we are not showing reverence to the old gods. We're tearing them down. We're undermining them. We're ridiculing them. And again, ridicule that. Whew, you know, if you ridicule someone in the way that we've ridiculed cucks, that's almost worse than like literally punching them in the face. You know, it's worse to be insulted, to have that, to have someone who gets under your skin and keeps you up at night, and who, that's so much worse than actual like physical violence. It's violence of the mind, and we've done that. And I think in some ways we had to do it. You've got to like look. What is really, and this is why I think the conservative thing was so great. I mean, look, what is really standing in our way? Is it the left and social justice warriors? Well, not really, because they're always going to be there. These are huge, you know, institutions and ways of thinking that's always going to be there. What's directly standing in our path are these conservatives who have basically been the safety valve. They've been the red herring of the right, where they take you in the wrong direction. And the fact that we're attacking them, getting under their skin, is vitally important. The other thing I would add about this, just in terms of the kind of craziness of a lot of the memes, and look, a lot of the memes and a lot of what people say, like, it offends me sometimes. You know, you're talking about the cuck and his bowl or whatever. Not really my style, to be honest.
Prepping the bowl?
Right, prepping the bowl, yeah. No, you know, and I don't usually say that kind of stuff myself. I allow others to, but not my style. It, you know, I find it a little offensive and embarrassing. But
sure,
at the same time, like, you know, let's also be honest about it. You know, what was more important for the left in the 20th or in the second half of the 20th century? Was it like publishing this academic book, or was it winning over artists and musicians and cartoonists?
Stuff?
Yeah, like to ask that question is to answer it. Academic stuff, that always comes afterward. You know, academicians are always kind of instinctively conservative. You know, they're talking about what happened 30 years ago, or 300 years ago, or 3,000. They're like cataloging how society has already changed. And politicians are also a lagging indicator in most always. But, you know, it's like winning over that culture, which is just so much more important. Today, obviously, the rock music of today, you could say, is Twitter and Facebook and social media and all the related stuff. And they've made a huge dent. That is amazing. And that is more important than the academic stuff. The academic stuff, in a way, kind of comes later. You've got to win over the social media, so to speak, to win.
With Trump, obviously, part of most of his success is that he is a pop culture icon. But
yeah.
I see Trump as an like a political ideological bulldozer, because he's not necessarily on a very like highbrow level intellectually. He's not always coherent in his like speeches. Well, he says he may even say things that contradict himself, but the main role he plays is this political bulldozer. He tears down kind of the establishment's ideas and makes them and mocks them, and that's his effectiveness, not so much like his political platform.
I totally agree. I don't think his policy is the detail. Let me say it this way. The details of his policy aren't important. I think it's the big brushstrokes. It's the ban Muslims. It's the let's get out of NATO. I think that might actually be the most radical idea that he's promoted, because that's really, you know, turning 180 degrees on the trajectory of American foreign policy heretofore, you know, after 1945. I mean, that is really radical. Banning all Muslims, getting out of NATO, they've got to go. You know, are we a nation? He'll ask this question, you know, over and over. Are we a nation? If we're a nation, we'll have borders. It's those big brushstrokes. It's not the nitty-gritty of policy. It's the big brushstrokes. It's the emotions that are important. And he's definitely, you know, conveyed those in spades.
And you can also see how figures that are on the mainstream right, sort of the more subversive end of it, like a Stefan Molyneux or even Alex Jones, like you'll see them go back and forth, like a Molyneux on Jones's show. And it's, you know, and they're in a way talking about our ideas, maybe not directly, but they're getting to this point, which is insane.
Well, look at the people we've influenced. And look, I always try to be skeptical. I don't want to ever get on my high horse and start saying we're winning over the world or whatever. The fact is, our ideas, and I'm talking about the whole breadth of race realism, identitarianism, and related things. These are the most dangerous ideas. These are the ideas that freak people out. These are the ideas that are verboten in our society. And, you know, because we're dangerous, we're pushing people in ways. We're changing them. Stefan Molyneux. I mean, I've always respected Stefan Molyneux because he's a very thoroughgoing libertarian, and he's also like a really charismatic guy. You know, does really good videos and podcasts. The fact that he is now, I mean, he's just an open race realist. He's not an identitarian, I wouldn't say, but he has talked about the existence of race in ways that he certainly did not talk about, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and that he's talked about it in a way that was no one else, you know, is talking about in the mainstream media. That's an amazing. Ann Coulter. I always joke about this. I used to hate Ann Coulter because she was this, you know, George W. Bush supporting maniac.
Democrats are the real racists.
Yeah, right. Dems are the real racists. It's funny how, you know, because Dems are the real racists. It's a really great Twitter account. He might be the best account on Twitter. But that's also kind of a meme that's the ultimate conservative meme. Keep in mind, in 2012, Ann Coulter wrote a book called Mugged. A great bit of that book, you know, probably like a 10% of it was dedicated to that exact argument. Democrats are the real racist. It is conservatives and Republicans.
The other conservative meme I see floating around is now that Trump supporters are actually racist Democrats.
Right.
Dixiecrats.
There's always a kernel of truth to these things. The fact that Trump has you know, energized a lot of people in like Massachusetts, you know, I think in a way they're right. But to go back to what I was saying, like Ann Coulter, you know, 4 years ago, she was writing a book that could have been called Democrats Are the Real Racist. And now she's tweeting things about, you know, why are you talking about Israel? How many Jews are going to vote for you? Why don't you talk about American? Like, it's this, you know, still plausibly defensible, but really basically implicit identitarianism or white nationalism, whatever you want to call it, or at the very least American nationalism. And the fact
she's writing for Vidare.
Oh, she's definitely been reading Vidare for a
long
time.
She writes for Vidare, yeah. I'm not sure how recently.
Well, I might be wrong about this. I think they publish her syndicated column.
Okay.
Also, Milos Yiannopoulos at Breitbart, he's played a major role in mainstreaming the alt-right, but he also uses sort of a meme war tactics. He does like a lot of publicity stunts to get attention, like kind of like the troll culture.
Exactly. Milo is not one of us. He is not. But the fact is, you know, and I say he is not an identitarian. However, the fact is the idea that he, because he's one of these people that, you know, wants to go there. He wants to really piss off liberals. He wants to think those dangerous thoughts. He's that type of personality. Probably has a lot to do with his sexual orientation, to be honest. The fact that he looks to us as these are the dangerous ideas. This is the real dope. This is the hot stuff. Very interesting. He has done as much as anyone in the sense of bringing our ideas into the mainstream. And now, you know, the alt-right, like you when you say alt-right, that has a currency. It probably doesn't have a currency yet amongst normal people, you know, living in Nebraska. It definitely has currency amongst Washington people and I would say, you know, people who are in the game, reading about it, you know, following this stuff. It definitely has currency. And I would say 5 years ago, if you said alt-right, that wouldn't mean anything to anyone. Now it really means something.
Last year, 2015, was like the first time I heard mainstream publications mention it. As you said earlier, it's a combination of Trump and the migrant crisis.
And also I think Gamergate plays very strongly into this.
A lot of people, you know, a lot of people will take these paths, and one of the paths that people take is definitely through the manosphere. I think Gamergate, because of Anita Sarkeesian, that the gaming, you know, and I'm not a gamer to be honest, but you know, so I wasn't really even into the Gamergate stuff, but Anita Sarkeesian was just so crazy, just such a like the quintessence of social justice warriordom, that, you know, she was just directly attacking these guys. And then they started reading like the Manosphere stuff, maybe pickup, you know, culture stuff. Then they started reading, then they, you know, oh, look, there's V-Dare, or there's Radix, or there's, you know, your podcast or something. You know, there are these little paths that people take. A lot of people were red-pilled by the Trayvon Martin controversy. And they look at that and like, what's going on? What's happening? What is this? And they're like, oh, I'll read this, I'll read that. You know, there are a lot of different paths, the paths of the red pill that people take. And I think it's great because they seem to all be ending up at the same place.
Well, there is sort of this mainstream kind of alt-right, the sugar-coated mm-hmm. alt-right that I'd say is like the can't stump the Trump YouTube videos. Have you seen those?
Oh, yeah.
Well, the graphics and all that. And then so it's like sort of the Trump crew, the people that sort of just embrace like bashing liberals and spreading Pepe Trump and, you know, the get them out, no coats, all that kind of stuff. And yeah. what I see is that, okay, like Milo's speeches and all like Milo and the Trump alt-right, it's good because it gets people meeting, it gets people talking. I know Milo had the whole like white male scholarship thing. But
yeah.
I think the problem is, I mean, is there a problem in a mainstream alt-right? Because I was watching this one live stream, and, you know, they start talking about culture in the same way that a leftist would. Someone brings up Jared Taylor, and none of them know who he is. So, for me, that
well,
was like, oh, you guys know Jared
funny.
Taylor?
Well, it's kind of funny. I think we have to be open to this kind of stuff. Like, I coined the term alt-right, but to be honest, one of the reasons why it has this currency now is because it's not alt-right does not equal Richard Spencer or my agenda or something. You know, alt-right has been it's been able to have a life of its own. I think maybe that's, you know, that you've done something when, you know, people are talking about ideas that, you know, might originate with Jared Taylor, but they never even heard of Jared Taylor. And maybe it's bruising to one's ego, but it maybe is the best thing in the end. And so I think that I agree that there might be a problem if people start they latch onto the alt-right and they really neuter it and they just take it in some stupid direction. I've seen this website called, I think it's called The Rebel. It's a Canadian website.
Oh, and Lauren Southern and Gavin McGinnis. And
yeah, you know, I'm not, you know, I like Gavin and Lauren Southern.
Gavin sort of got me into all of this kind of stuff.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Just watching, because, you know, yeah.
Yeah,
definitely.
No, I
show
actually
was a
brought
gateway.
Gavin to Talkie Mag, and
he
started writing.
Yeah, and Jim Goad, too, right?
I didn't bring Jim Goad.
Okay.
He was friends with Gavin. I think Mandolina probably brought him after I left, Jim Goad. But, yeah, I brought Gavin, and I remember I pissed off all of these conservatives because Gavin is writing these, you know, curse-laden articles about he had one article. Can I curse on this podcast? Or?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. He had one article called Fuck Single Mothers, parentheses, figuratively. he did stuff like that was, you know, pretty trollish, but very good. I was saying, like, the Rebel, and it is a Canadian media. And again, I, you know, Lauren Southern, Gavin, you know, I'll agree with them a lot of the time. I'm not definitely not against them. They're definitely not.
It's funny you mention that because he did a video response to Matt Forney's article about like 10 signs you're a conservative. And I think he agreed with maybe 7 out of 10, but he had 3 of them where he had like a strong, almost pretty much a strong disagreement.
Yeah, but he's moved on from there, though.
Give them time. I guess my view of it is that, like, I think we should watch out. I think the leader of the Rebel is called, like, Ezra Levant, and he's just a total neocon. So I think
totally.
We should, you know, just watch out for people like that. But the other end of it, I don't think we should also be these, like, Puritans where we have to, like, force everyone to agree with this catechism or, you know, they must memorize these kind of – I mean, I think, you know, maybe we should do – maybe we should have
my
some basic core elements.
my point was not that you have to be like ideologically pure. I was just sort of pointing out the interest that there's sort of this like these different degrees of overlap, like on a Venn diagram.
Yeah, I totally agree. What I'm saying is that I think we need to be somewhat open, because if people who are normies are taking like 10% of our ideas and they're not maybe ready for the other 90%, or they don't know the other 90%, or whatever, I think it's still a good thing. Like, I don't think we should just police these people. I think it's better just to kind of let them go. Let them start to think through these ideas. Maybe it's going to take them a year to fully think through them. I think it's that's fine. And I think the idea like that, you know, you saw a live stream where people were using alt-right, they were talking about things, and they had no idea who Jared Taylor was, and they maybe would even, like, deny race.
Definitely, yeah.
You know, maybe it's good to punch them a little bit and kind of push them a little bit, but maybe it's good just to kind of let them go. They'll end up in the right place in 6 months.
Yeah, I think hopefully. It takes a while. I mean, even for me, there was a period of kind of fighting these ideas, even though I instinctually believe them, and then just sort of coming to terms with it, and then now I'm talking to you. So there we go.
Right. It happens with a lot of people. I mean, I was. It's interesting with me. I think that I was fairly philosophically radical a while ago, let's say 12 years ago.
Yeah. I relate to that.
But then I wasn't quite. But then I would also probably say, oh well. Race doesn't really matter. Like, I don't want to talk about. Like, I would kind of resist some of the real world ideas. But then I would almost. But at the same time, I was, you know, reading Nietzsche and Heidegger, so I was fairly philosophically radical. But not. I was resistant to a lot of our basic ideas. And you do fight with yourself, because to adopt the ideas of the alt-right, I mean, look, you're being the ultimate radical. You are joining a counterculture. You are going against the dominant mode of our society, and that is that's rather painful. It's not for everyone, and so it's got to take a long time. I think, in a way, if our ideas were kind of cheap and easy, like, oh, we've got some new, like, cute little policy idea that Matthew Iglesias came up with in order to lower rents in urban areas for, you know, Latino single mothers or whatever, that's not what our movement should be about. Our movement should be about these big ideas that are painful to digest.
One trend that you're starting to see, and you even did a video about this, is sort of the eventual sort of death and decline of a conservative ink, and that really goes back. I think that really goes back to Buckley and the founding of a National Review.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's got to happen, because this movement is old, and this movement isn't really of the current year. And I say that a little bit jokingly, but seriously as well. That was a movement that was hatched in the mid 50s by people like Buckley. It seemed to have on top. It seemed to be many Catholics and also some various immigrants, and it was a Cold War ideology that was about embracing America and freedom and capitalism. So it had a kind of libertarian quality to it, but it also had a very non-libertarian, better dead than red, you know, let's roll back the Soviet Union, very hard, or you could even say kind of Kennedy-esque, in a way, Cold Warrior aspect to it. So it was a kind of amalgam of that, and on top of that, you could throw in some of these Catholic ideas, but also this kind of general, a general vague cultural conservatism. And that was the stew that was created. And yes, it's true that they've floated left and changed some little positions here and there. They first opposed the civil rights movement, then adopted it. They first were, you know, very much against anyone questioning the Vietnam War. That was the reason for the Buckley's purge of the Birchers and others. Then, you know, 1980 comes around, and they're like, oh, yeah, we too think the Vietnam War is a bad idea. You know, so they kind of float around. But they actually do have these core ideas, this pro-capitalism, libertarianism, this anti-communism, which became anti-terrorism, and a kind of vague, hazy American values or something like this.
The three core, like, tenets and groups within a conservative Inc. Basically, you have fiscal conservatives, you have evangelicals, and then you have sort of the basically foreign policy hawks, neoconservatives. And Trump doesn't really fit into any of those groups because on social issues, I mean, he has sort of these, like, quote-unquote New York values. He used to be pro-choice, tolerant of homosexuals. On foreign policy, he wants us to get out of NATO. He says he can, like, get along with Putin. On economic policies, he's even talked about taxing the rich. He's in favor of keeping some kind of entitlements, a social safety net. So he doesn't fit into any one of these core groups of conservative Inc.
Absolutely correct. That's why I think conservatives are right to fear him. You know, Peter Brimelow, who, friend and colleague, he would say things like, "Well, I can't believe that the conservatives are opposing Trump. Why would they do this?" And I disagree. I think that they are right to oppose Trump. I think they correctly view him as a threat, someone who is basically winning, but not winning using their ideas and their he's not speaking their language. And so he is a threat to the continued existence of Conservatism Inc. This is a very interesting thing that's happening. He's also showing an important point, which is that Republicans would very often win by talking a lot about their great love for free market capitalism, the need to have an American empire and expand abroad, and how they would talk about how, you know, we need to protect the unborn or we're all these Christians. Well, Trump has proven that a lot of people would vote Republican for, you could say, kind of for identity reasons. Like they voted for Republicans as the Democratic liberals are crazy leftist and the GOP is the party of normal white people. That's why they were voting Republican. They were not voting Republican due to their, you know, deeply held commitment to free market capitalism. And so Trump has proven this. And again, that's a major threat to Conservatism Inc. Conservatism Inc. has been around a long time and they haven't really changed. And so it was inevitable that they were going to go away. Trump is basically pushing them off the ledge, or at least I hope he is. I think what the conservatives basically want to happen at this point is they've more or less accepted the fact that Trump is going to be the Republican nominee. A few of them are still, you know, Bill Kristol and some others are maybe still have dreams of a third party or taking the nomination away at the convention and so on. I don't think that's going to happen. They basically accepted that Trump is going to be the nominee. And I think what they want to happen is that he loses big and Hillary is in there and they get another 4 years of fundraising off Hillary. We just return to normal. We basically say, oh, we told you so. He was a bad candidate. We got to go back to the old ways. I think that's what they want. They want this kind of reset where everything just goes back to 2012 after Trump loses. Well, I'm not sure Trump is going to lose. I think Trump very well might win. And even if he loses, I think he's broken through in this way that I'm not sure we'll be able to go back. And
way,
so, again, I just think this has been a tremendous achievement.
In a way, is it almost worse for them if Trump loses? Because there's already all of these, you know, people on the left who are very disillusioned with the system with Hillary Clinton. And these people are primed to become us, and a lot of them are becoming us. So I think, really, either way for them in the long run is a losing game.
Yeah. I mean,
we can make them feel young again.
Right. No, that's the thing. I mean, I don't think we need Trump to win to have achieved something. I think we probably would achieve more if he wins. I think that would be interesting because if he wins, I think you could just objectively tell conservatives, look, we don't need you anymore. You guys suck anyway. and you guys don't understand your base, and you're not the future, clearly. And so, you know, bye-bye, you know, Eric Erickson. So I think it would be better if he wins, but I agree. I think it's just like he's broken through. He's broken the ice, and once it's broken, you can't really go back. It's very interesting. I think I might have tweeted about this. Maybe not. Yesterday I was just walking my dog, and I was just listening to Eric Erickson's podcast, which is basically a recording of his radio show. Very interesting. Eric Erickson, totally lame, you know, utterly conventional ideas, boring. All of his callers, to a man, without an exception, were basically white men who were ragging on him for opposing Trump. They're like, what are you doing? This guy's great. We like this guy. This guy, what do you want, Hillary to win? No, I mean, this is, you know, it was really funny. I think there's a growing disconnect between Conservatism Inc. and their base, even on like the talk radio side, where it should be more, you know, they should be united, theoretically. And again, I think this is very interesting. It's conservatives who have been standing in our way, and it's conservatives that we've got to push away. We've got to displace them if our movement's going to move forward. We're not going to really displace the left, or you know, that's not going to happen. It's we've got to displace the conservatives. They are the more immediate enemy. And it's happening, slowly but surely. I mean, again, we should also be realistic. Conservatism, Inc., because it has this legacy, because it's been attached to the hip to the Republican Party, I mean, it has a tremendous fundraising and financial legacy. I mean, we're talking, you know, the Heritage Foundation, what is their annual budget? It's in the millions. They've got a huge endowment that resembles a small liberal arts college or something like this. So this is going to be very difficult, but it's going to happen. And I think what we're going to see in the coming decade, maybe two decades, is this just slow motion death of conservatism. And I would say a slow but steady and inevitable rise of identitarianism.
Yeah, that's the thing that'd be interesting to see what replaces Conservative Inc. Do you think that you could see sort of like a radical center that combines aspects of like a Trump and a Sanders movement?
I could definitely see that. I mean, I joke with people. With Bernie Sanders, I definitely agree with more of Bernie's issues than Ted Cruz's issues. And I agree with a lot of Bernie's issues. I mean, sometimes I'll come to different conclusions. But, you know, I think a huge motivation for a lot of Bernie's young supporters is that he talks about this huge burden of student loan debt. Now, my conclusion is that fewer people should actually go to college. I think it would be better if people were in trades or just went into the, you know, had an apprenticeship, just went into the world. I think, you know, college is not for everyone. It's you know, we have this, there's this myth of college that also, this is a myth that's got to break down at some point.
And it's also an indoctrination center now. I mean, you go to college, I mean, went to school, and I had to unlearn half of what I learned in the last few years. You know,
right? Yeah. I mean, it's kind of amazing that parents, conservative parents, will pay for this. I mean, the leftists really, they did something really amazing where they were getting middle class white people and Wall Street to fund their indoctrination centers. I mean, I have to hand it to them, but it's not going to last. And, so, I mean, I might come to different conclusions, but, you know, look, I think the world would be a more peaceful place with Bernie Sanders than Hillary Clinton, or certainly Ted Cruz, or even though Ted Cruz made some America First noises, I don't really trust him.
He sort of follows Trump.
Invade Russia. You know, he's attached to his father's kind of more of an old line realist foreign policy camp. But, you know, I would imagine the neocons would be leaping for joy if Jeb ever got in there. And I think Cruz as well. I think they could have definitely worked with Cruz, particularly on this, you know, Israeli fundamentalism. But I think things are really changing. I think there are these Bernie Sanders people who will come over to the alt-right. And I think it would be very interesting. The right that emerges, the new conservatism that emerges, really has a different, you know, constellation of ideas where, you know, one of the big ideas is let's protect entitlements. One of the big ideas is let's get rid of student loan debt. That would be kind of interesting. One of the big ideas is let's stop fighting foreign wars. It would basically be a reversal of conservatism. And
Richard, have you said that we are the new left in a way? I remember a podcast where you said something like that.
Well, I say these things, so I think sometimes saying things like we are the new left, I mean it, and I'll say something provocative, hopefully to get people thinking in a different direction. And
sure.
To get people away from thinking of we're just extreme versions of the right. So, you know, we are identitarianism. What is that? Oh, that's Glenn Beck times 10. You know, so no, it's not Glenn Beck times 10. That has nothing to do with Glenn Beck. We're not an extreme version of Glenn Beck. And we're something different. We're starting from a new place. And I would also say, just structurally speaking, we are the new left in the sense that we are what leftists imagine them to be. Leftists always think of themselves as this, you know, underdog, you know, anti-establishment, you know, truth to power speaking, you know, trodden, poor people's movement for a better world kind of thing. Well, they're not. They're an institutionalized establishment organization, basically. We are like that. I think the alt-right is clearly more bohemian. It's clearly angrier. It's clearly speaking truth to power. It's clearly talking about those things that the establishment does not want to talk about. And so in this kind of ironical way, we are the left. I mean, we, structurally speaking, we are the left. We are the new counterculture. We are the new left. And,
so should we start reading critical theory and getting into that kind of thinking?
Well, I think we should. I would recommend reading critical theory, for at the very least, for the fact that you should understand your enemies, and I think that's a good thing. But I think we should also read critical theory for other reasons, in the sense that, you know, one of the impulses for critical theory was basically that the Soviet Union was a kind of false start, or that socialism, that the Soviet Union wasn't the answer, and that these social structures that are existing aren't just a kind of material reality. They're not just a product of capital accumulation or control of the means of production. There's a consciousness element to it all, that you need to change culture. You need to change the way people think in order to change material reality. I absolutely agree with that. I think we should be a kind of critical theory, in the sense that we want to subvert the dominant paradigms of the establishment in the modern world. We want to make them. We want to kind of look up their skirt a little bit. We want to show them those things that they don't want to see. And I think also, just as pressingly, our movement is not going to succeed when we, you know, send the illegal immigrants home or something like that. Because, you know, first off, that's not going to really accomplish anything in the real world. I don't think that would change things pretty dramatically. But also, even if we did that, we would just be, you know, we would just kind of like start over, and we would end up in the same place. You know, it's like, oh, now all the illegals are gone. Oh, but, you know, all their children are citizens, and we're headed in the same direction. No, we need to change how people think. We need to change what's up and down. We need to change what's right and wrong and what's moral and immoral. We need to change people's minds. And that was the project of critical theory. I think they succeeded. That really is our project. Our project is an idealistic project. It is not a purely material project that, you know, America will be saved if we only, you know, increase funding for the border police or something like that. No. Our movement is going to succeed when normal people and certainly elite people as well have different ways of thinking, where different up and down. And we also, one of the reasons why our movement has had so much trouble succeeding is precisely because we are viewed as radically immoral. You know, a lot of us will say quite correctly that race realism or something like that, or identitarianism. This is just common knowledge. These are common assumptions 100 years ago, 200 years ago, so on. That is true. But the fact is, at this moment, race realism and white identitarianism, at least, are basically the most immoral thoughts you could think. It's not just wrong, it is immoral in the minds of certainly the elite and in the minds of a tremendous amount of normal people. We've got to change that. We've got to change the way people view the world in order to change material reality. That was the project of critical theory. That is now our project. So anyway, listeners have learned, we are the left. We are the new Frankfurt School. We are the new Marx. Kind of funny, but it's where we are.
So we can use the tools of subversion against themselves?
Exactly.
Is there anything you recommend reading? Are there people we should check out?
In terms of critical theory, I would probably say, I mean, just in terms of the quality of the writing, I would probably say Dialectic of Enlightenment by Horkheimer and Adorno is an essential text. I don't know how you can't not read that text. Volta Benjamin is, a lot of his stuff is very poetic. He talks about history. I think that's all very interesting. Well, I think you can kind of get into their mindset if you read, some of Adorno's, even some of his essays on music and things like that. In Search of Wagner is a really interesting text. Again, you don't have to agree with them. You don't have to, go down that path and end up at his destination. But I think it's good to kind of get in their mind to understand their thought process. So I would probably start there. I'm sure there are probably some good, in terms of critical theory, there are probably some good collections out there. I'm kind of out of date because I was in grad school 10 years ago. I'm sure there's some new books. But I think just kind of dive in. I would say Theodor Adorno is the most cultured and intelligent and kind of powerful of these people. But, once you get into his mind, you can enter the mind of some others. But, yeah, I think you should definitely read the left. And I would also say that one of the major problems that we have is that the right, at the very least in America, the right has been so impoverished. You know, we had the Buckley movement. We didn't have the French New Right and the Alain de Benoist and Guillaume Fay movement. We had the William F. Buckley
like
and Jonah Goldberg
extreme
movement.
Sort of anti-intellectual streak on the American right, where if you're sort
Absolutely.
Of almost sort of adopting the sort of a leftist liberal stereotype that if you're an intellectual, that's sort of delegated to the left, or you're somehow, I don't know, like you're either like effeminate, you're homosexual, or you're European or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's like Russell
and,
Kirk.
We have Kirk, right. I'm not a huge Kirk fan, to be honest, but he is a serious person, worthy of being read. But he's about it. there is this
Rothbard
conservatism in America. Rothbard, you say?
Yeah.
I would definitely
like
recommend reading Rothbard. I wouldn't associate Rothbard with the conservative movement just because he was so anti-conservatives for more or less all of his adult life. I definitely think people should read Rothbard and Austrian economics. I mean, again, just to kind of get in their mind and see how they think. There were some interesting some of these emigre intellectuals at the first, say, decade of the conservative movement. But, look at the stuff. And certainly the Regnery family published some very important and worthwhile books with their press. But, look, let's be honest. Look at the stuff they're publishing now. What is a conservative text? Does it ever go to a higher intellectual level than some of these one word titles
liberal
like
fascism.
Treason. Yeah, right. Liberal fascism by Jonah Goldberger. I was joking about I was joking with someone like you create a parody of conservative literature and it's like a one word title and a long subtitle. So it's like treason, Hillary Clinton's plan to appoint Osama bin Laden to the Supreme Court, Total. That was the one I came up with.
That's great.
Stupidity.
I gotta start doing that.
that kind of stuff. And it doesn't ever go beyond that. It's just this, it's this very here and now, like, let's win this latest election, you know, very, you know, like the liberals are bad, woo, you know, kind of stuff. And, you know,
and then we become them 5 years later.
Exactly. You adopt their policies, you know, 5 years later. Exactly. You can see that with gay marriage. It's amazing how just within our recent memory, how that people, you know, conservatives would oppose it and then kind of sort of oppose it and then accept it and then claim that they invented it.
It's with the transgender thing, it's like they didn't even argue it.
Right.
Because the PC has been, you know, just they're basically a kowtowing to the PC, and they don't even want to present the counter-argument anymore. They just want to do it as long as it's in the free market.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of these people, you know, the conservatives now, they in a way just don't – they've just given up on the culture war, and they don't want to fight it at all. I noticed that there's this one – I believe his last name's Cook. Charlie Cook, I believe, Charles Cook.
Charles C. Cook.
Yeah, conservatarians. And it's just basically like, let's not fight for our values. Let's not fight the culture war. Let's just fight for free markets. Or I know that one thing that Lauren Southern and Milo put forth is we are cultural libertarians or something. You know, again, okay. You know, it's like, yes, we should have more ideas than social justice warriors allow us. Fine, I agree. Whoop-de-doo. But all they're basically saying is, like, no one's going to win the culture war. We're not going to really fight for anything. We're just going to kind of fight for the right, I guess, to party in the case of Milo, but fight for the right to kind of, like, think whatever you want to think. It's liberalism, basically. And it's just, like, it's not going to work. This is,
Yeah. I think these people are getting a little more extreme, though, as time goes. Like, you said, like, give them time. Like, I know Chris Cantwell, you were on his show somewhat recently, and he's sort of gone into our territory. Then Lauren Southern's been talking to him, and he's pushing our stuff on her. So, I mean, I remember, like, seeing Milo speak, and, like, you know, all these social justice warriors in the audience are going crazy. And I yelled physical removal at one of the protesters. And Milo, I looked at him, I noticed he saw me say that and started laughing hysterically. So he's definitely up on us. Very, very up on us.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, they're totally up on us. And again, I think with a lot of these people who you could describe as fellow travelers, I think Milo might have literally described himself as a fellow traveler of the alt-right.
And I think
Lauren Southern is similar. Again, you can push them. You can say you're wrong about this. This is not going to work. This doesn't lead anywhere. I don't think we should just be like attacking them or anything like that. I think it's good to have fellow travelers, and the fact that smart young people, you know, think that the alt-right is a cool place to be, that is a very good thing.
There's the whole concept of degrees of separation. And if you have a degree of separation to the mainstream, that does give you a sense of legitimacy as opposed to being kind of an island. It's kind of like the old game people used to play, like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Right.
6 degrees of Richard Spencer.
I hope they're playing that game. Well, the fact is,
I'm
going to
start it.
Yeah. No, I would be flattered if 6 degrees of Richard Spencer said.
I'm
going to
make that a meme. That's my 2016
goal. The thing is, you could connect us. It wouldn't be 6 degrees. It'd be like 1 degree in some cases. I think, you know, that we're getting to that point is a very good thing. I think this is a real accomplishment.
I mean, back to, like, you mentioned Gavin McInnes. You could do that game where Gavin McInnes is on Sean Hannity's show, and Sean Hannity interviews Bill Kristol, and Gavin McInnes is connected to all these alt-right figures via Tacky Mag. So I guess by degrees of separation,
Gavin was mentioning Richard.
Kristol.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's like 2 degrees of separation between me and Sean Hannity. I guess that's a little scary.
So you got to don your jeans and your blazer and get on the
or I would a conservative you mean pleated khakis and
oh pleated khakis and blue blazer, sorry.
But yeah, I mean we're influencing them. And I think also we just gotta keep it up. I mean we've gotta keep the pressure on, and we've gotta start to work to build a more professional movement. And we've also got to not put all our eggs in the Trump basket, in the sense that if Trump loses, which I do think will be a bad thing, I hope Trump wins, we shouldn't make that a, you know, oh, now all is lost now. That was our one chance. That was our last chance. And now it's all over and blah, blah. No, we've got to keep going. We've got to make this Trump was our first opportunity. Trump was the first word. He was not the last, or he's not the last chance or anything like that. He was the first chance. And we've got to make it that. And I think that's going to be our challenge in the next 5 years, because we have this little boomlet going on, but it's going to, you know, the boomlet will just kind of get old, and we've got to keep moving forward. We've got to keep a greater professionalization of our movement, and we've got to keep, you know, moving forward in terms of influencing people.
We should be a becoming movement. Changing.
Exactly. Yes.
Beautiful.
You're adopting all
movement.
These Richard Spencerisms.
I know. Yes. I know.
Come who we are.
I know. I know. It's good.
Each a reference, but I put my little twist on it.
We are basically out of time, so I'd like to thank Richard Spencer and Alex for being on.
Well, thank you. It's a lot of fun. Time flew by. Let me mention something real quick. Just a plug. You know, the MPI conference this year, it's going to be after the election. It's going to be on November 19th. So I think that's a really great opportunity for us to, you know, we'll have digested what happened, and we can talk about what's next. And so, yeah, it's in Washington, D.C. at the Ronald Reagan Building. You actually can register at this moment. I'm putting the program is I'll be announcing soon. And it's going to be bigger and better than anything we've ever done. And it's just a great place to meet people and, you know, hear some good speeches. But I think more important than the speeches is just, you know, I think we're going to have like 250 people, 250 shitlords together in a room and, you know, eating and drinking and networking. I think that's a really great thing. So, you know, be there or be a cuck, I guess is what we should say.